Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. My next guest is Helen Slinger. She's the director of the new film on CBC called Hold Your Fire. It's about police shootings. It's about mental health. It's about so much more than that. Helen is with a company called Bountiful Films, bountiful.ca. Check them out online. And go to cbc.ca and you're going to find out a lot more about how many people were killed in police-related shootings between 2004 and 2014, and about how many different mental health-related calls, 20,000 alone in Toronto, that police respond to every year. I mean, that's an astounding statistic and the thing that these police officers have to deal with. I mean, it's just so deeply unsettling on so many levels. We talk, Helen and I, about training and de-escalation techniques, and we talk about fear and misunderstanding and mental health issues, and about body cams that the police are now wearing, and about pursuing the difference between help and how that can be presented in a situation like this, and the whole idea of listening and just a more relational kind of edge with respect to policing and de-escalation techniques and so on. So mobile crisis teams, we cover a lot of ground. I think you're going to really enjoy this interview. Again, the film is Hold Your Fire. You can stream it on cbc.ca/firsthand. Helen Slinger from Bountiful Films is my guest here today. Well, welcome to Face to Face, and we're joined by a very special guest today, Helen Slinger. The Vancouver Sun said about her, quote, Helen Slinger's filmmaking is all about taking a grabber of an event and turning it on its head. The documentarian deliberately digs deeper, looking for a real meaning beneath surface shock, close quote. Helen, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So we're going to talk, I think, about a couple of pretty serious issues. This is not going to be necessarily a real cheery pick-me-up, this interview, but you never know.
No, you never know, but it's true. It's not necessarily your happiest time. It's not Netflix territory, exactly.
So tell me about your new film, Hold Your Fire. I believe it aired this week on CBC.
Yes, it aired the third week in January for the first time on CBC, and of course it streams for the next 6 years on cbc.ca too, so
nice.
You can find it.
Hold Your Fire is the title.
Correcto. So what it's about is essentially police shootings of people in mental crisis and how to stop that from happening. It started out being more broadly about police interactions, but of course you get down very quickly to the pointy end. There are a lot of reactions in Toronto, 20,000 police interactions with people in mental crisis in 1 year, 2014.
Which is an astounding stat.
It's an astounding stat, and you say to yourself, okay, well, they're doing it right. You know, these few that happen,
right,
like Sammy Yateem, that are fatalities, well, they're unusual. Well, they are unusual, but it's a matter of whether or not they should happen. And it's also a matter of unpacking the stat a little bit and knowing that most of those 20,000 are very routine calls. They're police officers being called to someone's house because they're having a crisis. They're a regular call. They call 911 because they're having a delusion. Police know who they are. They arrive. They maybe arrive with a nurse in tow, and they help that person either get to aid or they may call a relative. It's a pretty routine call. So it's not as if it's 20,000 Sammy Yateem calls. It's 20,000 your neighbor who sometimes is out of control call.
Right.
So it's what we looked at was, okay, so why do these few that happen so tragically happen? And yeah, that's what we spent a about 2.5 years looking at, is there a better way? We all know that's true what police say, that they don't get up in the morning heading out to shoot mm-hmm. somebody. We know
of
that's true,
not.
So why does it happen?
Yeah, why does it happen in the first place? So when you set out to make the film, would you say you knew this was going to be a movie about mental illness, or you knew this was going to be a movie about police shootings, or was it you weren't quite sure what the story was going to be, and it kind of unfolded before your eyes?
I knew my business partner and I in Bountiful Films have been looking at something around police interactions with the mentally ill for many years, just interested in what seemed to be a growing number of interactions that ended badly. And we have a friend who suffers from time to time in mental crisis that's you know, fairly extreme, delusions and things, and you fear sometimes that something bad could happen if the wrong police officer came across him. So that was the impetus over years of looking at, okay, what are we looking at here? Are we looking at programs for the mentally ill? Are we looking at police training? We didn't know what we were looking at. And then, like so many people, when Sami Yateem was shot on that streetcar in the summer of 2013, that focused us really sharply. Okay, mm-hmm. what exactly happened here? Not that we tried to be at all judge and jury on that.
Right.
But simply to back up and look at whether or not anything different could have happened in the system. Not so much with James Frisella, the poor officer who has to live with this for the rest of his life, too. But in the system, could anything have happened differently?
Well, it's just, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, yes, just yesterday, I believe I read, I think it was on the BBC's news page about how, might have been CBC, but 60%, and these stats are always troubling on some level and need to be questioned further, but 60% of soldiers were abused as children. And so you start to wonder about when you watch a film like this. I'm not suggesting that, you know, 60% of police officers were necessarily abused as kids, but you start to wonder about some of that, some of those connecting points, right? What preceded this kind of violence? What precedes this kind of a response? You know, nine shots to take down Sami Yateem. It's, you know, the quote in your film is, quote, you answered a call for help with 9 bullets. That's a pretty profound statement.
It is pretty profound. I wouldn't. We didn't look at Priscilla's background, and I'm less interested in Priscilla's background. Other than, I think we make the point much later in the film that police need to look at recruiting, and that's not
right.
That's not us saying that. That's Terry Coleman, who's the expert that police listen to, saying that.
Right, right.
That they're not cautious enough in recruiting, and I think most people know by now that one thing we do know about Priscilla is that he drew his weapon rather more often than is average for a Toronto police officer. So there's something to be looked at there, but I think I understand a lot better why he did fire 9 shots, and I certainly have my own theories.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it, and I can really imagine this isn't also the first film I've ever done about police, too. So I've been inside use of force training at the RCMP Training Center in Regina, and I know what's happening. I know how they learn to so fear anyone that might be carrying any kind of edged weapon. So,
right.
You know, in Sami Yateem's case, it was a knife. In the case of Robert Chikansky at Vancouver International Airport in 2007, it was a stapler. There's this reaction to anybody holding anything, and they're trained that anything could be lethal. So that's in your head, I think,
sure.
When you approach something like this. You're not. It's not just whether or not, you know, what kind of a childhood you had and how secure you are in your person, although, of course, that affects everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's this noise. I think there's just a cacophony in their heads about how dangerous the situation could be. And I think that anything that police are trying to do in terms of de-escalation, I think it still, to a larger extent, and again, I think this is changing almost month to month, too. Police are really struggling with this. But I think that the de-escalation training is being built on top of this use of force training, which is about how your life could be in danger if somebody's holding anything or might be holding
right.
something. And I think that's what happened with the first 3 shots. And then, frankly, I think he panicked.
He panicked after that, yeah.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting that at the end of the film, the solution is starts with recruiting and the 2 points was it Jim in the film? I can't remember his name right now off the top of my head, but says better training, higher training, and some kind of mental health experience.
Yeah.
Kind of understanding, whatever that means. I mean, do you have to have a past in it? I don't know, but maybe just more training, I suppose.
Yeah, more training, and I think in the recruiting piece is really important in terms of what kind of person that you're getting to.
Mm.
Terry Coleman was the police expert that we used, who's a former police chief, and he's written a few, he's co-authored a few big reports on police interactions with people in mental crisis that have actually been presented at the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police. So we know that this guy's like, he's got the seal of approval from the chiefs of police.
Right.
He knows
right.
what he's talking about. And he's the one who makes the point about recruiting. And he goes on, I think this is something that's on the CBC website, on the Hold Your Fire page for the CBC website, is more with Coleman about recruiting. And he goes on to say that he thinks they just move too quickly, trying to fill quotas
right.
for police officers,
yeah. yes.
that they're not always looking carefully enough at some of the flags that come up that say, maybe not this person. So there's that. And, yeah, Yakabuchi, who wrote the report after the Sami Yateem shooting, he was really specific about looking for education and, yes, experience in mental health. And, I mean, you can, you and I could come up with a list of what that is. I mean, it could be somebody who's volunteering in mental health, could be somebody who's taken some courses, could be somebody who has a brother or sister with a, you know, with a major problem and has dealt, has a different point of view rather than
well, it's
average
just,
folk.
You know, some of the, I got to say, Helen, the images in the film, some of them I found profoundly disturbing and oh, man, tragically violent. I mean, I guess all violence is tragic, but there's something about the violence in this film that's really quite understated, but yet so in your face. And the images of a man in a white, basically hospital frock being shot dead on the street by, you know, surrounded by stronger men, guys with guns and weapons and so on. And you go, for the love, like, guy, why didn't you just talk to this guy? Now, I mean, I know I wasn't there. It's so easy to pass judgment. And yet you guys really juxtapose it so well with the UK case and the machete and the way the British police officers, you know, ultimately took this guy down in a nonviolent way.
Yeah, I found the Michael Elligon, the man in the hospital gun, really disturbing too. Now, police, the officer was cleared in that case, and he would very likely have been the Michael Elligon in his hospital gown looking to any average person like a person in need of help, not bullets, still carrying two pairs of scissors. There's some reporting about whether or not he said something that sounded threatening, too.
Right.
But he is all those things. He's the guy that police are trained to be afraid of. He
right.
gets too close, and he's holding an edged weapon, two edged weapons, actually. So the thing to me that kept getting to me is, why do they have to? There's many eyewitnesses to that case, too, that said, oh, he was just like, you can hear the dispatch call, as a matter of fact, in the film, with the 911 officer asking, does he seem dangerous or confused?
Right,
well,
yes.
Well, confused.
Yes.
So a lot of people saw that, but still police were called to something where, you know, a guy, a disturbed person is carrying scissors. So it's not as if there was no danger at all, but the thing that got to me is, why do they have to come up so fast and hard? Nobody was in immediate danger at that moment. There's lots of other information, including the fact that guy's in a hospital gown, that tells you that, you know, he's not necessarily
yeah.
trying to kill somebody.
Yeah, he's not in fatigues, you know,
no,
and doesn't have grenades on his, you know, I don't know, it's so easy to look at this in hindsight and all that, I get that, but at the same time, I mean, I think what's so brilliant about your film, and congratulations on it, by the way, is that again, it's raising the issues, right? It's getting people hopefully talking about it, going beyond scratching the surface and peeling back some layers to say, well, holy smokes, how do you deal with this kind of thing? If I come across it, I love what you did with the Hamilton team and just even making us as the viewers aware that some of this is going on, way underfunded, of course, but something that maybe these mobile crisis teams are a step in the right direction.
Well, I think they're a step in the right direction, but it's very interesting because I think it's when we started making the film and I started reading about these mobile crisis teams, that you know, the partnership of a police officer and some kind of mental health worker going out together, I thought, okay, well, this is great. Like,
yeah.
that would have saved Sami Yateem's life for sure.
Sure.
And then once you actually start getting into it and getting out in the field, I realized that you'd have to have absolutely every team in a jurisdiction be a mental health team. Otherwise, you could never, ever guarantee that, especially not in a city traffic like Toronto, you bet. Especially in a city like Toronto or Vancouver where the traffic's really bad, the odds of getting one of those mobile teams to a crisis,
right.
very small.
Very small,
so every
yeah.
team's got to be trained. That's not going to happen. It's expensive. Why not just train every officer much better. Right now, for I think Toronto and most cities, the sort of gold standard for how many of your regular officers are trained in crisis intervention training is something like 30%, 25 to 30%. Well, I just think that's goofy. That's that's like having 25 right. to 30% of your officers trained with their firearm.
Right.
I'd really rather flip that around so that 100% of your officers are trained in crisis intervention training and fewer of your officers are trained for firearms, which is essentially what happens in the UK, where, you know, they have their problems. It's not a perfect policing environment there either, but they don't shoot anywhere near as many people, and the attitude is simply totally different.
The attitude's different. That's the sense I got, you know, when you were interviewing one of those officers. You know, he looked at some of the footage, and he said, oh, I don't even think we would have called for weapons on that call. You know,
on the team call. No,
yeah.
There isn't.
Which is fascinating to me. I mean, talk about a different culture and a different approach.
Yeah, and I can imagine I can so easily imagine, having spent time in the back of police cars in Canada, the U.S., and the U.K. now, I know what would have happened in the U.K. is that they would have possibly closed the streetcar door on him. I'm not even sure they would
right.
have done that.
Yeah.
But they would have stood back,
mm-hmm.
and they would have talked, and
right.
they would have brought some kind of, and you hear this in the documentary too, they would have figured out some way of containing him without bringing him down.
Well, I thought it was really interesting with the way that you show the I don't know, seven or eight officers kind of surrounding the guy with the machete on the street. They had him cornered by a hedge on one side. They were clearly very aware. No weapons. They had no weapons. They were waiting for the guys with shields to
yeah.
arrive. So the police officer arrives with shields. These men and women come in. They kind of form a perimeter around him and almost, you know, box him in, basically. And then get them on the ground and handcuff them. I mean, it just, I don't know. You go, wow, that just seems so smart.
It can be done.
Yeah, right, exactly. It can be done. Well, and the other thing that really struck me is it's a more relational approach to policing, which you know, can you think of a better way to build a wall by pulling your handgun? You know?
Well, exactly.
It kind of shuts down the conversation, doesn't it?
It's truly, they truly go back to the, you know, Robert Peel. There's a statue to Robert Peel near one of the places where we were filming in the UK, as a matter of fact. He's a British parliamentarian who's seen as being the father of modern policing.
Hmm.
He was all about a very fundamental concept that police are citizens.
Hmm.
And it is that you're not removed from the citizenry, you
right.
are still part of the citizenry.
Right.
So it truly is we are them and they are us. And they simply have this particular responsibility at this time. And it sounds so, I don't know, philosophical and simplistic in some ways, and yet I think that's actually where Canadian police need to dig, is back at this really fundamental cultural stuff. And it's not like I think that's simple, because we do live close to the United States. We do have more guns in the culture than
mm-hmm.
we have in the UK. So there are differences. But I do think that there's a possibility of truly understanding that this crisis intervention training has to be across the board. I think there is a cultural shift that can happen still, where you're putting use of force training on top of de-escalation training, as opposed
mm-hmm.
to de-escalation training on top of use of force training.
Did it ever come up? Did you and others working on the film ever just say, why don't you guys just shoot to wound? Why do you have to shoot to kill these folks?
We of course asked lots of.
Yeah, can't you just take the guy down?
I came to believe the general response to that, because I heard it from too many very good officers, that really average citizens who have not been in this kind of a situation really don't have any idea how difficult it is to do that.
Right.
That the reason they're taught to shoot center mass is not so they'll kill somebody, but it's simply because it's a larger target and there's a reasonably good chance of hitting it.
Yeah, yeah. Shooting somebody in the leg or the calf is not necessarily
yeah.
as easy as Clint Eastwood makes it out to be.
Well, exactly.
Yeah,
I'm with the why didn't you just back up? That's the
right,
question
that to right.
me is fundamental.
Yeah, I mean, if it's 21 feet, we'll move to 25 feet, right? I mean, what? There was a video you guys showed about surviving edged weapons out of the States that said you needed 21 feet between you and the potential perpetrator, I guess, to react. Well,
was an exercise to show how quickly people can move.
Right. So if that's really the perimeter, then can't you, like you say, can't you just back up?
Yeah, and do you want to start with your weapon in the first place? Is I'd back up
right.
further.
So are the police officers in the audience listening to this right now, Helen, going, yeah, you guys don't understand?
It's actually been a really interesting response. There's been some, yeah, you guys don't understand. And there's been quite a lot of quite quiet, mostly coming into my email, but a little bit actually even on Twitter. There's been some really encouraging response saying that they think the documentary is good and that it's been screened. I know it's been screened in senior circles. And I think, I mean, I tried not to be black and white and confrontational because I don't think the police are black and media
right.
is white. Or I think we all are trying to do a good job here. I think we all do have the same core goals. So I tried not to be, I don't know, I tried not to be cheeky. I just tried
right.
to be thoughtful.
Sure.
And I think that thoughtful police officers have been able not to agree with everything that we did, but to say, okay, well, is there something in here? Should we actually maybe try to be open to whether or not this sheds any more light on the changes that they're already trying to make?
You talk a little bit about, I love that Albuquerque, by the way, comes up in your film. It just always makes me laugh when I hear the word Albuquerque, and I'm not sure why. I think it has something to do with Bugs Bunny, but he should have taken that left turn at Albuquerque.
It's one of those places, Albuquerque.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Who decided to name it Albuquerque? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. That makes me tempted to Google it right now.
So this, and then I think at that point you talked a little bit about this aggressive police culture coming out of the U.S. And maybe the implication is that it's, you know, having an impact and having an influence on us up here and in Canada. And then the lawyer that we see in the film says, you know, a police officer that he had talked to on a particular case said once in response to kind of the whys, well, first we get control, then we answer questions. So that's why we pull our gun,
yeah.
you know, or at least that was the implication. The quote is, quote, first we get control, then we answer questions, close quote. And so is that, I mean, are they connected? Is it really kind of, you know, you talk about Robert Peel and being citizens, but are we talking about a power dynamic here that's kind of maybe getting out of hand?
Well, yeah, I think so. And I think in Canada, we are caught between these two policing cultures. And I think that's...
Sorry, caught between two policing cultures?
Yeah, we're caught between our old British history.
Right, okay, yeah.
Which would lead us back towards, you know, more de-escalation, more of this notion of the police officer as just another citizen, and this American gun-happy culture. It is also interesting traveling in the back of a police car in the States, I'll tell you, because you suddenly have this different awareness that, yeah, anybody driving past you, any traffic stop that this officer makes, there's a reasonable chance that that person is packing. I mean, it's just the most bizarre feeling.
I remember coming back from Colon, Michigan with a friend of mine years ago, long, long time ago, a guy by the name that a friend of mine, David Penn, and he was pulled over. We were pulled over for speeding. I was in the passenger side, and I will never forget, it was late at night, maybe 1, 2 in the morning, quite late, so I guess we would have been suspicious at that point. And the guy, two cops, one came up on the driver's side, and the other police officer stood at the back with his gun drawn through the back window. And I was totally freaked out by that. And I mean, like, holy smokes, guys, it's us. What are you doing? But then on reflection, well, you know, dark night, dark road, no lights, you kind of don't blame them, right?
Well, yeah, in the States, you kind of don't blame them. I don't know about pointing the gun right at you.
Oh, yeah, it was, whether it was pointed at our heads, I don't know, but it was certainly pointed at the car through the back window. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and we traveled with an officer as he made several stops, and yeah, you see him get out, and this is pretty routine police stuff, but he's got his hand on his gun.
Yeah,
and
I bet.
You know why.
Yeah, yeah. Different culture for sure.
Yeah.
I think I don't know, I don't want to sort of, you know,
David, what we were told, and that was one of the things we were looking at, and one of the reasons, the chief reason we went to Albuquerque was to hook up with that training institute that you see every
right.
from there. And they happened to be in Albuquerque, and Albuquerque has a terrible reputation,
right.
well-earned reputation for shootings of the mentally ill. So that was a lucky or unlucky
right.
happenstance that Caliber Press happened to be training there at that time. But the reason that we wanted Caliber Press or any of the big American training outfits was because we've been hearing from a lot of police officers that Canadian officers have been going south to take these kinds of courses.
Interesting.
And
okay.
We do know that Calibre Press trains through Canada, too. So this kind of very, I think in Canadian terms, it's hypervigilant. It's pretty normal for American society, but I think Canadian police are maybe getting this sort of hypervigilant attitude that comes from American policing. I don't know that it's necessary. I think we still can reach back for that British model where you can de-escalate your way out of most situations. But, you know, most people, most calls are not violent calls. They're not bad guys anymore. They're people in distress.
Would you put it in the sense that there's a more, in the UK or the UK-based system, is it more relational, Helen? Is it more human in a way? Or is that a fair distinction to make?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, in the UK, police officers are more part of the community, and they appear to be more part of the community. When they're out there, they're much less. There's not quite the same feeling that there is when a police officer enters a coffee shop in...
Interesting.
In the United States.
Interesting, yeah. It's true. That's so funny that you say it that way, because it immediately took me to that. You know, an officer walks in and you're just sort of impressed by the uniform and the weapon and the hat and the size of them usually, right?
And the guns.
The guns, exactly. You're right. There is a moment. It's true.
The message is power.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And that's not the message you get when you travel with British police. You do get a message of help.
Right.
So, yeah, it's very, very different. And can we do something about that? I still think we can. I think and hope that Canadian police are going to spend a lot longer in the UK thinking about how to incorporate some more of this culture, because I think it is doable. I don't think we have to drink the Kool-Aid that comes from south of the border. I think we still have that, the option of a much nicer cup of tea from the UK.
Right, right. What did you learn about mental health? I mean, you know, what about vulnerabilities, about the fact that we're all broken? I mean, what kind of things bubbled to the surface for you there?
Well, a big thing, as you know, is that, you know, the statistic is that 1 in 5 of us will suffer some kind of mental crisis in our lifetime. We all know that. I think probably most of us have in our connection somebody who suffers, at least somebody, if not more than one person, who suffers fairly badly. So I think the big thing that came up here was, again, simply the vulnerability. If you're sitting, as I was, in your backyard, and you're watching somebody that you really care about who's having a particularly bad bout in their illness, and they're heading off downtown on the C bus, and you really wonder, you know, what they're heading into, and you're really hoping that they don't get, you know, in the midst of a delusion, get too vocal and look scary to somebody else. And that, I think, is the thing for all of us, is that, yeah, your loved one didn't get shot, but
right.
When you see not just Michael Elgon in his hospital gown, but Michael McIsaac naked in December weather.
Yeah, tragic
for
story.
Any one of us,
yeah.
And there are so many of us who have loved ones in that situation, it's that we do have to look differently. And there is a way, too, and I think we all know
one of the things that struck me is, I mean, don't we all just want to be listened to? And I mean, that's the sense I got with some of the folks that the shootings that you say, wow, if I could have just sat down with these guys in a coffee shop or in a hospital room or if we could have got them in front of a counselor. And I'm sure that's happened for many of these folks for years, I suppose, if they've been suffering from mental health issues. But this whole idea of it comes out a couple times in the film where, you know, so this guy's shouting at you and then the police shout back. What's that going to do? That's not going to help anybody, right? It's just going to confuse these folks even more.
Yeah, and that's a point that mental health experts will make, and that police are still trying to get a handle on, trying to train the stuff but haven't yet, is if you're already hearing voices in your head, and then there are a bunch of people that start shouting commands at you, the odds of you reacting to that calmly are very, very small. In the UK training that you mentioned earlier, you see, even though they're coming into a guy raving, and they're holding shields, you still see that they talk about this in their debrief afterwards, they appoint one person to do the talking.
Right.
Still, even though they're holding large plexi shields in front of them, you still have one person quite calmly making contact
right.
with the person in crisis. So that's the kind of thing that, you know, that still can be done for people. And that's, again, the stuff that I think police are trying to learn.
Yeah,
they still
yeah.
think that to make that training effective, you have to incorporate it all the way down the line. You can't
right.
apply that over
yeah,
top of, oh, my God, he's holding a knife, so all bets are off.
It's got to be top down, bottom up. So it's fear, but it's also misunderstanding.
Yeah, fear, misunderstanding, and it's, you know, if you're going to have to react very quickly in dangerous situations, I'd say you get a kind of trained instinct, and the trained instinct change.
Yeah, that becomes the first reaction, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the more positive response, the relational response, the eye contact, whatever that might mean. Tell me about Rialto and the body cams. Really interesting. The stats that they tossed out about the drop in complaints and the drop in violence and so on. There's this sense of, I guess, the police officer now is being watched. They've got a camera on their, is it on their shoulder? It's kind of strapped to their shoulder.
In there, it's, yes, it's on their shoulders in Rialto. You see me hesitate there because there, in some places it's on your shoulder and some it's on your glasses.
Oh, okay.
Actually, Rialto, I think it's on your glasses, but I'm not sure. One way or the other, yes, it records everything that happens. You know, when they go in the morning in Rialto to their morning meeting, the first thing they do is grab their body cam from the row along one wall, flip it on, and it's on for every public reaction. They turn it on before they go into any kind of reaction. So, yeah, it was really interesting. So the other thing I thought was neat about this was that the police chief in Rialto is a guy who happened to be getting his Ph.D. at Cambridge in the Institute of Criminology. So it's the other thing to know about police. There are a lot of much more educated police out there now, and that's, I think, a change that's just making its way through policing, too. But he decided, since the first wave of body cams were just coming in as he was taking his postgraduate degree, so he decided that he would make that his thesis.
Hmm.
So everybody, all of the officers for a period of time were wearing the body cams. And what they discovered was an 88% decrease in complaints against police, which is interesting.
It was so very interesting.
Police are behaving better, or people are knowing that they can no longer make specious complaints against police, or both. But there was also a 60% reduction in the use of force. So, I mean, that's huge. 60% is huge.
It's crazy. So what? Okay, so the cynic in me a little bit comes out here, and I guess the philosopher a little bit too. So let me get this straight. You got to incentivize ethical and moral, good, decent behavior? So in other words, I'm going to get in trouble because I'm now on camera, so therefore I won't yell or shout or swear or pull my gun.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. We all have these inner voices. We all have, for most of us, I think it's probably our parents that are with us always.
Right.
And if your parents...
Great. Thanks for the reminder, Helen. Yeah.
You're welcome. I love having my parents in my head most of the time.
That's right.
But, you know, depending on who your parent is, that inner ethicist may not be as strong as you'd like them to be. Now, maybe those people should never be police officers.
Right.
I don't know. We all slip.
Sure.
It's another way of saying that everything I do is public and transparent here.
The idea of being watched, right? I mean, that changes everything. I mean, if you think somebody's watching you, whether it is your parent or it's a friend or it's a neighbor, you are going to behave a little bit differently. There's no question, right? I mean, just something as simple as the window being open when you come out of the shower, you know? I mean, you're gonna have a different reaction, it seems to me. So this idea of, well, it's used punitively too, right, with kids. In schools and in prisons, this idea that we're always being watched, we're gonna change the way we do things.
Yeah, we are. And, you know, we could talk a long time just about that. There's definitely some better and worse things about that.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, and I went in thinking, okay, privacy issues.
Right, yeah, sure.
Storage issues, how you sort through all this stuff. I went in not totally sold, and I came out pretty sold. On
wow. Well, and also just, you know, from a filmmaking perspective, I mean, there was the film a couple of years ago, I can't think of the stars in it right now or who directed, but End of Watch, I saw it at the Toronto International Film Festival, and it was essentially, most of the film was filmed through police cams.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen it or not, but it's going to, I would think it's going to open up some doors for filmmaking in the future, for certainly for documentarians.
I've not seen it. I just wrote it down.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of, like, the Elegant case that you saw, the man in the hospital gown.
Yes.
That's the police dash cam.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, because that's a whole other world, right? The dash cams as well.
It is, and the thing about video, generally, however you capture it, whether it's Paul Boyd, the man in Vancouver who's crawling across the street when the final fatal shot's fired, or whether it's Elegon in his gown, or whether it's the McIsaac video, which is a little bit of just a passerby, the naked man who was having a seizure out in Ontario in December. All those pieces of video were the things that made it possible and necessary and probable, I guess, that a real conversation was going to happen about whether or not there could have been a different outcome. Did these people have to die? If there hadn't been video on any of these circumstances, the chances are very good that what would have happened is what happened 10 and 20 years ago, which is that police say, you know, we did, there was a threat, we did everything we could. It was basically a good shoot. And we had to accept that at some point because we had nothing else. We had nothing, we had no other kind of evidence to allow us to look at it and see whether or not we as a concerned public saw something different. Now, police will tell you that you can't tell everything in a video, and of course we know that. You can't tell everything in a video, but you can tell some things. And in fact, if I can rant just a tiny bit about the Paul Boyd case in Vancouver is a classic for video because Mr. Boyd was shot in 2007. The officer was cleared. It seemed like he was definitely mentally ill. Something was going on.
Yeah.
He had a chain as the reporting. When police arrived, there was an altercation between him and an officer. Sounded like he had come at the officer. What could the officer do? He shot him. The video didn't surface until 3 years later in 2010, and it was simply because a tourist had heard about the police officer being cleared and went, hey, I kind of remember that. I think I filmed that. Finds the video on his phone, and what you see in the video is that whatever transpired beforehand, at the time that the fatal shot's fired, this man is on his hands and knees, nothing in his hands, crawling across the street. So without the video, the case was reopened and a bunch of other stuff happened. But without the video there, it simply would have been another case of, well, we just did what we had to do and Bob's your uncle.
Right.
Same thing with Chikansky. I mean, training in Vancouver in British Columbia for police officers changed dramatically after Robert Chikansky was tasered at Vancouver International. And it changed because of the video, because it was clear that there could have, should have been a different outcome.
Yeah, it's so, I mean, I'm sensitive to the fact that, you know, we don't, I mean, you would obviously understand this way more, having made the film and so on, to stand over here and to look into a situation or to videotape it and go, oh yeah, I get it, and isn't it horrible, is really such a massive oversimplification of a pretty complicated issue. And the reality is 20,000 mental health calls, essentially, is that right, a year? That the police respond to? I mean, that's
20,000 plus in Toronto.
Yeah, just in Toronto. Wow. Wow, that's pretty significant. So in a sense, the numbers are incredibly low. So, I mean, that's, I guess, the good news. The better news is that your film and other training and so on is going to hopefully change the way people think and the public thinks, but also, more importantly, I suppose, the way the police respond.
Yes, and I think the Forcillo case, I think the fact that he faced charges in the shooting of Sami Yateen, and that, well, he hasn't been exactly convicted, but certainly he's been tried. I think all of that has made a big difference. It makes it impossible for police to look away from this stuff. It makes it impossible to not say, okay, the public really needs us to do something different. Whether or not we feel we were justified in the way we acted, the public, who is our employer, is telling us no, we have to look at this again.
So can I circle back? We're probably going to have to wrap it up here shortly, sadly. But can I circle back to the original one of the original questions I asked you? Is this a film about police shootings, and or is this a film about mental health?
Both.
And it's unfair to polarize it like that. But
it's both. I mean, it's very much. I think it is a film about police shootings of people in mental crisis, and can they be prevented? It's a that. It's more about police than it is about mental illness, for sure. I mean, there's a lot more to be said about different kinds of mental illness, about the system. There's so many more things that could be done by us as a community to make things better for people who suffer from serious mental illness. But essentially, when somebody calls 911 because somebody's acting bizarre on the street, it's more than likely going to be police who attend.
Right.
And whether or not they should, whether or not you see this as being something that's been dumped in their lap, it is going to be police that attend. And we need them to be trained well enough so that it ends well for people on both ends of the gun. I mean, you don't even want to think about what happened to James Frisello's life, too. The Yateem family was destroyed, so was the Frisello family.
Mm.
I think the film tries to make the point, or at least tries to open up the thought, that there is another way of doing this, so that, as they say, everybody goes home at the end of the day.
Well, I think it's wonderful what you guys have done with it. I love this idea of, you know, creating more space. Right? Creating more space for others. I mean, to me, that's one of them. I mean, there's so many different messages in the film. And like you say, we could talk about power and structures and systems and all kinds of different things. And this isn't about pointing the finger. It's hopefully about coming to a better understanding of the other and not just about how to get along, but living together and so on. I think it's the fear, the misunderstanding. I guess it gets us a little step closer to being a little more human. That's kind of what I take away.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, that was one of the reasons why we wanted the public to meet the victim.
Mm.
What you tend to hear after a police shooting is essentially crazy guy behaving dangerously dies.
Right.
And that hurt all over again to families who had already lost somebody. So, yeah, we wanted to remind people being both the public and the police, that these are people that were lost.
Helen, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate it. I hope we can, at some point, it's become kind of a tagline for me almost, but I hope we can do a part two down the road. There's so much more we could chat about. And I wish you well on your next project. Thank you for joining us today. Helen Slinger with Bountiful Films, the bountiful.ca, and the film Hold Your Fire. Check it out on cbc.ca/firsthand, I think. It's going to be there. Did you say for 6 years, Helen?
Yeah.
It's going to be downloadable for 6 years. Thanks so much, and congratulations.
My pleasure. Thank you, David.